Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and welcome to Valley Edition. On our program today, when it comes to animal control services in Fresno, why can't the city and county work together? We will update the current arrangement the city has with the SPCA and look at how Bakersfield has resolved its animal control problem. Plus, with State Senator Michael Rubio's resignation, who will take up the fight against Valley Fever? And who are the movers and shakers in Fresno under age 40? But first, it has been 6 months since the city extended its contract to have the SPCA continue to provide animal control services for the city. That contract is up in a few weeks, and the city is still a long way away from setting up its own animal control program. But as we learn in this report, the city is moving forward very slowly, and the SPCA seems to be willing to continue its role until a permanent solution is found. It's a Saturday morning, and they are serving up pancakes at the Central California SPCA in Fresno.
There we go.
Thank you.
Enjoy.
It's a fundraiser to help support one of the organization's new programs called Snip and Chip. It's a low-cost spay and neuter service for low-income pet owners. Executive Director Linda Van Kirk is happy with the turnout.
Well, look at the crowd out there. It's going absolutely fantastic. We are expecting a crowd of about 500 to 600 this year versus the 300 that we had last year. So we're ecstatic.
Fundraising campaigns like this one, plus help from a lot of volunteers, is what the SPCA is depending on as it begins to transition into the kind of facility it would like to be. One that no longer acts as a law enforcer. One that no longer provides animal control services for the city of Fresno. When that will be is still up in the air.
It's a little unnerving because we don't exactly know what changes we face. So that makes it a little bit hard to make a lot of plans. We certainly can plan for the items that are our core values, like the spaying and neutering, like education.
It was almost a year ago that the SPCA announced it was getting out of the animal control business and would no longer provide the service for the city and county of Fresno, ending what had been a 50-year partnership. Last fall, the county announced it was going it alone and decided to turn the old morgue building into a shelter. The Board of Supervisors voted to contract with the new company, Liberty Animal Control, to provide their service. The City of Fresno chose instead to extend its contract with the SPCA for 6 more months. City Manager Mark Scott says that operating agreement will be up in a few more weeks.
We are talking to them about extending beyond this time period. So I'm hopeful in the next couple of weeks we'll have an agreement drafted that would allow us to move forward with them on an ongoing basis while we work out the long-term plans to how the city can take over the animal pound operation, so to speak.
While the city hasn't figured out yet how it will move forward with animal control, officials know it will be costly. Scott acknowledges that the SPCA has been underfunded for years. The new contract is expected to include additional funding.
In this case, we're going to budget about $1 million a year more going forward for operations. Right now, we're going to be paying that money to the SPCA to continue to do what they do.
So for the city of Fresno, the SPCA continues to take in stray dogs, abandoned cats, horses, and a host of wild animals. People can still go on a Saturday morning and get their dogs vaccinated. Pet owners like Lynn Parsley don't mind the wait.
Well, they've always been good to my pet, and the cost is one of the biggest reasons I come.
Beth Caffrey, Director of Community Relations for the SPCA, says when it comes to stray and abandoned animals, the city and county split has been confusing for county residents and those who live in unincorporated areas. Many still show up, hoping to turn in their animals.
So our dispatchers are trying to do everything that they can to answer those community questions and get people to the right place that they need to be so they can get that help.
Caffrey says the SPCA's continued working relationship with the city is giving both the time they need to make the transition to separate entities. Fresno officials are aware of the challenges involved in setting up its own animal control service, starting with finding a facility.
The city is looking at a site near the sewer treatment plant on Jensen that has the facilities, has the land where you could bring in and construct the facilities for the animals. That has all the infrastructure in.
Fresno City Council member Lee Brand says it could cost an additional $1 to $2 million just to get the building ready. Add the cost of running an animal control shelter, and you understand why the city isn't rushing.
We have to take the time to do this right, and it's not simple. Nothing these days is simple. So we're going to have to look at all of the factors.
One option that appears to be off the table is a tax. Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea's proposal for a countywide sales tax to fund animal control didn't get very far.
I think the majority of the county elected officials decided it was too early to be talking about a tax, and we agree.
Council member Brand believes the city can generate additional funds by raising fees and getting more people to license their dogs.
We have an estimated 80,000 households that have one or more dogs, and we have 9,000 households paying license fees. And most people simply don't know they're supposed to pay.
SPCA officials say that's the problem they have faced all along, and not having the money for outreach and education didn't help the situation.
Well, we certainly would like to see direct funding for spaying and neutering. I think a lot of local government areas have realized that let's take care of the problem on the front end, which means that we're going to have funding for that front end.
Scott says in moving forward, he believes the SPCA still has a huge role to play in the success of any animal control program. He and other city officials are also hoping the county will come back to the table.
We're going to have to look at all of our options. We're going to get some people who have done this before into the loop and evaluating it. And we'll come up with our own analysis and hopefully include within that a role for the SPCA going forward, a role for other animal rescue groups going forward. And we'd love to have it work out to where the county and the other cities in the county are involved in one solution.
At this point, the county hasn't given any indication that it is ready to partner with the city to address the animal control problem they both face. Now, joining us to continue this discussion is Daniel Bailey, president of Liberty Animal Control Services, the company providing animal control for Fresno County, and Deputy Director Cheyenne Schull with Kern County Animal Control. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having us.
Mr. Bailey, now all indications are that the city is ready to extend its contract with the SPCA. And when I talk with city officials, they seem very much aware of how challenging this is going to be to kind of provide animal control services. Is that something you all are dealing with at Liberty as you work to try to set up this whole structure for the county?
We're getting things together, and like I say, it's been coming out, you know, of course a challenge, but we've been doing an excellent job. We've been handling the animal control for the entire county. We've also been working with some of the municipal cities within the county as well and helping out with the animal control with them as well for public safety.
At this point, how many animals are you all able to house at this point? Has that been able to increase any since you first opened?
You know, it started picking up as time started going through here with the months and stuff. And, of course, people getting to know that we're here, you know, with the animal control services, being provided for them in the county rural areas for the residents of Fresno County. And right now we're at about 176 dogs at the facility. We do have a few cats out there. We do handle the emergencies, injured, hit by car, vicious animals, stuff like that that's out, anything for public safety.
Now, at this point, kind of if you can describe your facility, have you all been given any indication when you might be able to upgrade at all? Because at this point, I think you're still without air and heat, or has that been resolved?
Well, we did get some shade cloths and stuff like that put around to get the animals a little bit more comfortable in there. We've had, of course, blankets go out with them every day and stuff like that, give them the comfort we possibly could for any animal that's out there. Our adoption rate has been excellent, and we've been working really closely with all the rescues and stuff. I mean, just within a few months, we've pushed out 180 animals or dogs out to rescue alone.
You've had a lot of success with that.
Yes, a lot of success, and also success with the adoptions. We've had people come in and sponsor animals where they will actually sponsor an adoption, where we could do free adoptions. We've done Chihuahua party adoption specials and stuff like that, where, you know, $20 to adopt the dog, and that comes fully microchipped, spayed, neutered with all his vaccinations, including rabies.
What did you think about the idea of the tax proposed by Supervisor Perea? At some point, I assume you all are going to need, you know, a permanent facility, and that would help.
I believe so, but we weren't really involved with the tax on the Measure H that they were looking at for the tax for the dogs and stuff. But like I said, the county has been really, really good with us. They've been helping us out in everything possible and taking care of everything we need out there. So, I mean, as for the county giving us the resources we need and stuff for doing the animal control, we do have it. I mean, we've been doing pretty good with it.
But for yourself, you said what they've been able to offer you thus far. But as you grow, how imperative is it that you really get the funding you need?
You know, it's very important. I mean, this is dog food to feed the dogs. I mean, the housing to house the dogs. And, you know, we do have an inside structure to put the smaller dogs, puppies, stuff like that. But, you know, we also have a quarantine area for our PC holds, which is our protective custody hold, stuff like that, for vicious animals or animals that done dog bites, stuff like that.
Okay. Ms. Shull, in Bakersfield, you had a situation where the city and the county seemed to have, you know, kind of a similar problem working as one entity, and the controversy seemed to be over funding.
That's correct. We're moving forward. We've made some positive changes, and last week we rolled out our new plan where the city and the county will work together, and we will have two separate facilities with one shared intake and adoption area. So that's our newest plan and idea, and we're planning to move forward with that.
How will that work?
Well, we still have a lot of details to iron out with regards to the logistics and the day-to-day and who will staff what and how all those things will work. But we are planning to share the same property, and the city will take over the county facility where we're at right now, and the county will build on a new facility. So we'll all be at one location. However, the city will take over the location that we're currently at.
Why was it that the city and the county couldn't work together and ended up having to split?
You know, I wasn't a privy to a lot of those meetings. I'm fairly new to the department. I'm sure that there's a lot of the similar struggles to what Fresno seems to be encountering. But the important thing that they finally decided to focus on is what is best for the animals and for the community.
Okay. Now, you said the county is going to have to build its own facility. Have they had an opportunity at this point to think about where the money is going to come from, where they will be getting the funding to build a new facility?
Well, again, this is a very new project that was just unveiled last week, so I think this is just the beginning stages of the planning. As far as where the funding will come from, we have not yet discussed that, but we at least have a starting point to work from.
Now, in the city and county of Bakersfield, what is your situation when it comes to, you know, stray animals, and what kind of success are you having with getting people to spay and neuter?
Well, as many communities in the area, we have a huge pet overpopulation problem, and we also struggle with trying to get education out there about responsible pet ownership. So we have made great strides in a lot of projects that we've worked on. We have a door-to-door street team that goes out and canvasses for license compliance. In addition to license compliance, they also give out educational information and resources. We offer a low-cost vaccination and microchip clinic twice a month for different areas in Kern County, where people are able to come in and purchase a license. They get their animal vaccinated for rabies. They get their animal vaccinated for parvo and distemper, and they can also get a free microchip. We do that twice a month. We also have a lot of promotional adoption events. We just had one on Saturday for St. Patrick's Day, where we adopted out 80 animals in one day from our facility. We ran a special for dogs and cats, $20 for dogs, $10 for cats, and it was very successful. And most recently, we have began a partnership with the Board of Supervisors in Kern County to put together a mobile spay-neuter events in different areas, districts, to offer low or free services for people in those communities, where we have already held two, and we had a very successful one on Sunday, where we had 28 surgeries, my correction, and we're still calculating the results on the vaccination and the microchipping of those of that event, but it was very successful. So we continue to grow our outreach. We're growing we have started a foster program where we currently have roughly 80 foster homes where we're able to pull those animals out of the shelter and put them in foster homes where they're one-on-one with individuals. And it opens up kennels in the facility where we're able to, facilitate more space for the animals coming in. And we also have a volunteer program that is continuing to grow in popularity. We have roughly 65 to 70 active volunteers that help us with a lot of different areas of the shelter and administrative work.
You know, I'd like to ask or pose this question to both of you. When you take a look at it, city and county here in Fresno, city and county in Bakersfield, you know, facing some of the same challenges when it comes to animal control. And a lot of it tends to be around having enough funding to do what you need to do. I'd like to have both of you maybe sort of address this, starting with you, Mr. Bailey. What could really help when it comes, what do you see out there as far as why do we have such a huge problem with stray animals and people taking care of their pets, and what can we do? What do you think are some of the solutions might be?
Well, education, like she was saying, you know, going out and do education programs and stuff, and we also do that where we will focus on the schools and get out to the children and stuff and talk to them about, you know, spay neutering, what it's all about, stuff like that, and, you know, different like fostering and volunteers and stuff like that that are working, you know, with the public and stuff, and again, radio, TV, things like that also to help, you know, express how important it is to spay neuter and pet overpopulation and keeping those animals, you know, in home and contained and not running at large. See, what we did is we did a program out there that if we pick up a stray animal or a dog that's running at large, we give two options. Option one is that you would pay the fines, the fees, the impound, and everything that goes with the boarding and care for the animal, which comes approximately about $100, a little over $100. Or option two is you pay the $50, have your animal spayed, neutered, and it goes back home with his license. You know, so we try, again, like, you know, with the education, working with the public, and if they get spayed, neutered, hopefully they'd stay home and not be running out at large and making more.
And on your end, Ms. Shule, you know, why do you think you see such a huge problem with, you know, stray pets and people really not, you know, taking care of the pets like they should? And how can you solve some – how can you find resolution to some of these problems?
Well, again, it is education, and it's about being proactive and not reactive. And our goal is to get out there and to make as many changes before the animals come to us and educate people and give them the resources that they need to accomplish being a responsible pet owner before the animal gets loose, before the animal is impounded, before the animal bites somebody. So we're trying to grow those resources. And you know, change is slow. This is something that we are addressing. We're going to be looking into continuing our license compliance program to increase revenue. We also are going to be increasing researching grants and different opportunities there to be able to do different things or broaden programs that we already have in existence, collaborate with other agencies to, you know, form a larger, more uniform resolution to problems, and also just continue to reach out and offer resources and work with other agencies. I think it's the best way to accommodate and to solve the problems that we have.
Now, Ms. Shule, it was mentioned to me, and please correct me if I have the wrong understanding of this, but it was mentioned to me that Bakersfield and Visalia, some of the other cities throughout the county, that they have an ordinance that says local vets have to do monthly reporting to the city of all the vaccination of animals because it's a public health concern. And that by doing that, you end up with a database of knowing who actually owns a pet in your county.
They do. They send us a copy of a rabies certificates that they administer rabies vaccines for, and then we can in turn follow up with those pet owners to assure that their animals are currently licensed with the agency that jurisdicts that area. So.
And so it was my understanding, because a Fresno official was mentioning that to me, and that is a way that when you know who owns a pet, making the outreach to make sure that the dog is licensed, spayed, and neutered, you have a database. You know, you have something to work from.
Absolutely. Once you get them into the system, you know, then you've got them in, and you can continue to, you know, keep track of that pet or that owner. You can send out renewal notices the following year when their license is due. So it's definitely a tool to be able to add to your database, for sure.
Do either one of you believe legislation can help the situation as far as, you know, requiring or mandating that pet owners do certain things? And do you think that if you start trying to mandate things, it makes it more difficult?
Well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ms. Shule.
I think that the key here is education. We need to reach out to people and give them the opportunity to make the right choice. When you have mandates or you tell people this is how it has to be, you have to have backing and support to be able to facilitate that mandate. And a lot of times mandates are well-intentioned, but we don't have the infrastructure to be able to carry those mandates out. So if we continue to reach out with the education and the resources, if we're able to get grants to offer those resources at a low cost or free, I think that in the end you ultimately achieve the goal that you're looking for.
And I'd have to agree. She's absolutely right.
Now, my final question to both of you is, is there a way, and how can city and counties kind of work together when it comes to animal control? And we'll start with you, Mr. Bailey.
All right. Well, again, it's working together with other agencies. I mean, you know, we're here and we love to work together with the SPCA, and, you know, they're out for a mission. We totally understand, and we are not pushing away City of Fresno. We welcome City of Fresno if they'd like to come aboard with Liberty. I mean, but again, it's working together with all the agencies. I believe that's going to be most effective. I mean, we're all here for the same cause, and that's to help the animals.
Michelle.
Well, you know, but all agencies are not going to agree on everything. Sometimes you just have to agree to disagree. And for us, we our focus is the animals and the public in which we serve. We want to offer adequate facilities to accommodate the number of animals that we house, and we want to be able to provide ease and accessibility to the public for our services in one location.
Well, thank you both very much for joining us this morning for this discussion. Daniel Bailey with Liberty Animal Control, providing services for Fresno County, and Cheyenne Scholl with the Kern County Animal Control. Thank you both for your time this morning. Appreciate
it. Thank you for having us.
Well, there is a lot of talk about the importance of high-quality preschool, but are politicians and the taxpaying public willing to foot the bill? On this edition of FM 89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State Professor Jack Benega says this new effort may fail if it's not properly funded.
A CNN analysis of President Obama's State of the Union address in February noted the president reeled off a laundry list of small bore proposals. The day afterwards, Mr. Obama crisscrossed the country advocating for those new programs. Among them is high-quality preschool for all four-year-olds. The notion of universal preschool is an old idea that is catching on across the country, with more than a dozen states ready to launch. Even Fresno Unified School District has gotten on the bandwagon by announcing the hiring of a new assistant superintendent for preschool education. The argument long made and raised again by the president is straightforward. Universal preschool will help children read and do math at grade level, graduate high school, hold a job, form more stable families, and reduce teen pregnancies and crime. Indeed, said the president, every dollar invested in early learning and development programs saves about $7 down the road in higher earnings that yield more revenue and lowers government spending. But it's certainly reasonable, in the face of all this excitement about the benefits of preschool education, to ask what exactly might it be about preschool education that brings about these positive effects. Here's the scoop. There are a set of well-done studies dating back to the 1970s that show positive effects on school attainment, even many years later. But recent studies seem to show that Head Start attendance alone doesn't increase children's academic achievement after third grade. And most early childhood classrooms don't do what experts say needs to be done. Indeed, they look more like watered-down first grades than like the programs most experts say children need. One study President Obama alluded to that seems to have long-term positive benefits for its young participants is a program started in 1965 that followed up its four-year-old students for almost 40 years. It's a program out of Michigan called High Scope. It worked generally the way President Obama described it because the curriculum was designed by experts who understood key developmental indicators of children. It hired well-trained teachers to design classrooms and implement the curriculum. It encouraged the children to make choices, solve problems, and otherwise be actively engaged. It included home visits by the teachers, and the teacher-student ratio was very low. Today, few states offer such a rich curriculum to their preschoolers because such programs are expensive. A notable exception is the state of Oklahoma. High-quality preschool. That's the slogan bandied about by political leaders to promote preschool education. We know what high-quality and preschool education should look like. The fear is that what may result will not be high quality because the programs that work are very, very different from those we may find affordable. High-quality preschool education, like high quality in any other area, is not cheap. Done improperly, it won't pay off. The president's intentions in this case are good, but the sloganeering is suspicious because, as yet, there are no details comparing what does work with what may be implemented. For The Moral Is, this is Jacques Benninga.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
As we continue on with Valley Edition, Valley Fever has become a fact of life in Central California. Last fall, then-State Senator Michael Rubio decided to finally do something about the disease. But following his abrupt resignation, families of Valley Fever patients and health experts are hopeful that other Central Valley legislators will take up the torch for the long-overlooked disease. FM 89's Rebecca Plevin reported on this story with the reporting on Health Collaborative.
For Central California families impacted by Valley Fever, it seemed like the long-ignored disease was finally gaining attention.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I want to thank you for participating and joining us.
That's former State Senator Michael Rubio. Last fall, he welcomed people to a town hall meeting on Valley Fever in Bakersfield.
My goal is to listen today and then capture a handful of action items so that we can go back to Sacramento and introduce some legislation to move the ball forward on this very important subject.
Following that meeting, Rubio drafted two pieces of Valley Fever legislation. One of Rubio's planned bills would have required mandatory Valley Fever training for physicians. The other would have allocated money toward Valley Fever research. He was also named the chairman of the new Senate Select Committee on Valley Fever. It was expected to hold hearings this summer to inform future legislation and counted two other Central Valley legislators, Republicans and Democrats, as members. Rubio's actions followed the publication last fall of the Reporting on Health Collaborative's Just One Breath series on Valley Fever. The series highlighted the lack of awareness of Valley Fever and government agencies' history of inaction regarding the disease. Valley Public Radio is a partner in the collaborative. Valley Fever patients, advocates, and health experts began to view Rubio as the champion that would finally shine a needed light on the disease. But Rubio abruptly resigned his seat in February to spend more time with family and assume a job with Chevron. And those efforts were left in limbo. Rubio failed to introduce either of the Valley Fever bills before the legislature's February 22nd deadline. The fledgling Valley Fever committee was left without a leader. San Luis Obispo County resident Tammy Schaefer was disappointed to hear the news. She was already working to support Rubio's physician education bill by collecting stories from Valley Fever patients whose diseases went misdiagnosed. Her advocacy has personal significance. She believes if doctors had diagnosed her husband Todd's Valley Fever earlier, the fungus might not have spread to his brain and spine.
When I heard that he had resigned, I was completely deflated and felt like everything that we had been working towards and fighting for was going to be completely lost.
But about 3 weeks after Rubio's resignation, Tammy and Todd Schaefer and others are feeling hopeful again, buoyed by steps, small ones, that indicate lawmakers' continued interest in the disease. Stockton Democrat Senator Kathleen Galgiani held a seat on the Valley Fever Committee. According to an aide, she has requested to become its new chairperson. She declined to be interviewed for this story. But Bakersfield Republican Senator Jean Fuller, another committee member, pledged to raise Valley Fever's profile among her peers.
Senator Rubio was critical and he was a great champion, but there will be others in the Senate, there always are, who will step forward and work with us.
In addition to those efforts, two Central Valley Assembly members say they are exploring ways to support Valley Fever research at the University of California, Merced. Already, UC Merced and Children's Hospital Central California have received seed funding for a Valley Fever-related research project. The university is also exploring two other research projects. Fresno Democrat Assemblymember Henry T. Perea said he would use the upcoming budgeting process to try to allocate money to UC Merced for Valley Fever-related research. Bakersfield Democrat Assemblymember Rudy Salas says he plans to meet soon with university researchers to determine what resources they need to move forward.
I want to learn more from them, what exactly they need, what resources they need, what doors they need opened so that they can continue to research Valley Fever and then find out how we can move forward.
Valley Fever advocate Tammy Schaefer is confident that another legislator will take up the torch for Valley Fever.
I think there are legislative people out there that will care enough about this that will continue it. But, we're going to have to move on from Senator Rubio's resignation and, find somebody else that can assist us in this area. At this point, it's something that I'm not going to just lie down and accept defeat.
Kings County Health Officer Dr. Michael McLean is also committed to backing Valley Fever legislation this year and next if necessary. He also supported Rubio's physician education bill and had provided feedback on a draft.
There is a continuing need for this, and I will continue to try to work for it. And if we don't get it this session, then we'll be back.
And that's a good thing for Central California, because the fungus that causes Valley Fever is not going away. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Plevin.
Now, continuing our discussion on Valley Fever, we are joined by Rebecca Plevin, who you just heard. She's a Valley Public Radio reporter, and Dr. Michael McLean, Kings County Health Officer. He is also a board-certified preventive medicine physician. Thank you both for being here this morning.
Thank you. Thank you.
And Rebecca, when you were reporting this story and you were out talking to people, I mean, there are other indications that there are other people who are willing to step in. But what was your sense in talking to them, just how deep their commitment is?
Right. So we found that, you know, families of Valley Fever patients and, you know, Valley Fever advocates and health experts were really disappointed when Senator Rubio resigned because they really saw him as the champion for this disease. You know, he was the first one to call a town hall meeting and he was going to be the chairperson of that Valley Fever committee, and he had proposed some legislation. And so people were really, like you heard from Tammy Schaefer, people were really disappointed. But as I started calling around to other legislators' offices, it sounded like there are other legislators who are also concerned about this disease, and it sounds like some of them are willing to step in and do something.
Dr. McLean, how do you think Senator Rubio's focus on Valley Fever has helped raise the profile?
Actually, I think Rebecca Plevin and her group did more to raise the profile than the
she says series, thank you.
The series of articles and programs on your radio station, I think, did a lot to raise the profile. And I have to say also that it's very important that individuals know more about it, because there is some evidence that when people know more about Valley Fever, they're more likely to be diagnosed and treated appropriately.
Do you all both, and especially you, Rebecca, because you were involved in those series of reports, you find that a lot of people just aren't aware, even though it's very prevalent in the Central Valley. I mean, there are many families who have been touched by Valley Fever that you think more people are becoming aware?
I hope so. You're right. It's a very prevalent disease. And even when I talk to people about it, they'll often say, oh, you know, I think my cousin had that, or I think my aunt had that. But I think a lot of people aren't really aware of it. They're not aware of how devastating it can be if you have a bad case of it.
I don't think people, Dr. McLean, are aware that this can be a fatal illness, a fatal disease.
I agree with you. I think that there has been in the past sort of a notion that it's a fairly benign condition and doesn't cause any serious long-term problems. Two things I'd like to point out. One of them is that even people who eventually do well and fully recover, sometimes that can take a very long period of time. They can be ill, and especially feeling fatigued, for a very long time, I mean for months, and people miss work, and I think there are some essential clinical follow-up that should be done on all patients, and for some a number of people in my county, that's a rather expensive thing because they have a lot of out-of-pocket expense.
And one of the bills proposed by Senator Rubio would allocate money toward Valley Fever research. Has that been one of the huge problems, just not having the funding you need for the research?
Well, I don't do research.
I mean, not yourself, but
okay.
I mean when it comes to learning more about this particular disease, is the industry or the doctors involved not having what they need to do their jobs?
Let me back up and just tell Valley Fever is an orphan disease, orphan meaning just like an orphanage or people who don't have parents. And the problem with being an orphan disease is basically something that doesn't worry people in Washington. And so it's a disease that only affects people in California, for the most part, California, Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. And Arizona and California are sort of the center of this problem, but it doesn't really affect or cause much concern in the rest of the nation. And that has implications for us all. One of them is that it basically doesn't have a large enough market to make research by the private pharmaceutical companies profitable. So it's very hard to develop new med. It's a fungal disease, and that's kind of fungal diseases are not very common problems in the United States. So, And so, yes, we are left with a lack of just some basic knowledge about the disease. And I think a lot of clinicians and scientists have been doing very good work with very little money, but we don't have any of the large, well-funded studies that can answer some of the questions that we would like answered. We don't have a medication that will reliably kill the organism.
And if I can jump in there, that's why it sounds like it would be exciting if there were possibilities of allocating money for Valley Fever research and development to UC Merced. We heard recently that UC Merced is interested in doing some Valley Fever research. They already have one study, as I mentioned in my piece, that has some seed funding. And so it would be exciting if there was the possibility to do more research and development at UC Merced, you know, in the middle of this corridor where there is a lot of Valley Fever.
And not only that, when you think about it, for UC Merced, it would give them a specialty, something to really, really focus on. And when you find a medical school or an institution that does that, you know, that's how you end up with those, you know, long-term studies, and you really start finding solutions and answers when you can do that.
Absolutely.
I know, Dr. McLean, you feel that it's very important for more physicians to be trained so they can better understand and better spot Valley Fever.
That's correct.
And so that's, you know, that was one of the pieces of legislation that Senator Rubio was putting forth. It's my understanding that he left before any of these bills were introduced. But how important is it to you, and what difference do you think we could see if more physicians have the training when it comes to Valley Fever?
We don't have all the data that we would like, but to give one example, the most serious complication is meningitis, and that's where the linings of the central nervous system are affected. And that's a lifelong infection. You need to stay on medicine the rest of your life, and early diagnosis of this probably will change the outcome. If we can prevent some well-recognized, the most serious complication is a condition called hydrocephalus, where the fluid doesn't come out of the brain the way, it doesn't circulate within the brain the way it's supposed to. And if you develop hydrocephalus, your risk of dying of coxemeningitis goes up by a factor of 12. And some experts, especially Janet Blair at the Mayo Clinic, has opined that she feels that the hydrocephalus and the strokes that we see in people with Valley Fever meningitis are a function of how long they have remained untreated.
You know, we're sitting here talking about Valley Fever like everybody knows what it is. I mean, we're all familiar with it here in the Valley. But again, let's just explain exactly what Valley Fever is and how people end up with it.
Valley Fever is caused by an infection with a fungus that lives in the soil. It is actually not unique to the, in California, it's not unique to only the Valley, even though it's called Valley Fever. Very small spores are inhaled and they set up in the lung. And the most typical illness is a very nonspecific, either just sort of an influenza-like process or pneumonia. And that usually comes on anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks after your exposure. And most cases will do well without any specific medication. They eventually take it or get control of it. Your body gets control of it. There are some exceptions, and that are the highest risk group. There are certain groups of people who are at risk for having it spread beyond the lungs, and we call that condition dissemination. And it can go anywhere. It can go to skin or joints or bone or, like I said, the lining of your skull or the lining of your brain. and probably somewhere between 5 and 8% of the clinical cases disseminate. The risk of dissemination is much higher in people who are of African-American or Filipino ancestry. There could be other high-risk groups, but we just don't have the data to make that case. There could be other high-risk groups based on their ancestry. And then we have people who have cancer treatment or have transplants or some of the newer medicines to treat arthritis. They're called immune modulators. So there are other groups that are much higher risk of having complicated disease. And the complicated disease can last years.
Yeah.
And
when it comes to valley fever, as both of you have mentioned, it's just something where we really do need continued research and continued monies going toward that. I'd like to thank both of you for joining us this morning, and you, Rebecca, for your excellent reporting on this entire issue.
Thank you.
And you, Dr. McLean, for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Kaiser Permanente Fresno.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition.
Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Now, if you want to know who are the future leaders of Fresno, just take a look at Business Street Online's annual list of 40 under 40. It recognizes the young rising stars in both the public and private sectors here in Fresno. Joining us is Lance Cardoza. He's the publisher and executive producer and president and CEO of Business Street. And Tim Finnegan Jr., Fresno Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram, and one of this year's 40 under 40s. Now, I want to ask you, Lance, what goes into really selecting people for this list?
The criteria, we really look at our young people of the Central California are our number one export to the Valley, and that's unfortunate. A lot of times we grow up here, and Tim can probably attest to this. You have the aspirations of going to the big cities and going somewhere else when we realize this is a great place to raise a family, and we have to keep those young knowledge workers here and celebrate their wins, creating connections for them. So the 40 under 40, the nominations come out through the year, come into 40u40.com, and it's a 250-word description on why the person should be nominated. And then from that, businessstreetonline.com selects the 40. We always have well over 40 every year. It gets bigger and bigger. It gets harder and harder. But to find jewels like Tim Finnegan Jr., I worked with his father years ago, so it was cool when I saw his name. I'm like, wait a minute, he's over 40. So to see that and then meet Tim, you know, I see a little bit of his dad in him, and to know that it's a young knowledge worker continuing the family business and seeing it flourish and do well. And from what I understand, Tim says it's doing really well.
Well, that is important.
Yeah,
you know, and for you, Mr. Finnegan, what was it like for you to be chosen and to be on this list?
It was a huge honor. When I found out about the 40 under 40, I followed it for a couple of years now, and then I got an email and a phone call from Lance, and I was very excited. I went home, told my family, and to be a part of the family business and be recognized in the Fresno community where I grew up and been raised, and I have four kids of my own, my wife and I, and it's just a huge honor, and very excited about Thursday night.
Now, as Lance mentioned, were you, were you one of the ones, did you ever move away and come back, or have you always been here and knew that you were going to join the family business?
I did. I went to Reedley College and played football there, and then I came back to Fresno State, finished my degree there in kinesiology, which nothing to do with business, but we're in the family business, and I love it. It is awesome.
Now, but this particular group, 40 under 40, there is going to be a reception.
Yes.
Or an event honoring them.
Mm-hmm. It's the ultimate networking event. It's in the Sky Room on top of the downtown Holiday Inn.
When you say the ultimate networking event, I'm thinking you get all of these professionals in one spot, and look what you have.
Exactly. And you talk about our list of on 40u40.com, the recognized class of class 2012. And I got to quickly add this real quick.
Go right ahead. Don't
Senator,
be quick.
Senator Michael Rubio. He was on the list. So it was devastating to us, too, to go, oh, no, you know, because he did so much good work. And I think that sometimes we don't have to turn the blind eye to I have a lot of respect for a person that for family reasons, there's probably something even deeper that with family we don't know about those dynamics that was very important to him at that time. And he's the one that introduced that bill and was the champion that took that first step. And I think you always have to remember that. There's a lot on a politician if they can say that the family is a reason and he took a different job and
he
did
was
that.
Certainly
he
one of the rising it. Stars yeah. in the political world here in the Central
yeah.
Valley.
I tend to have more respect for the guy, you know, now because it's tough to have respect for some of our politicians, but he did a noble thing, and unfortunately it made other people have to step up and continue their good work. But they were the team that were chasing it, like we were talking about. You always can't be the pitcher on the team. You know, at times other people have to step up and play.
What are some of the – when you look at some of the business and professions that this list of people reflect or come from?
The wide range is like for the car dealership with Fresno, Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, Ram, and another one, Fiat, because his brother runs Fiat, and they're opening a store in Clovis. Entrepreneurs and business people, that's the most powerful one to us because of businessstreetonline.com. That's really – we're looking at the business person. But at the same time, it's sometimes, again, the politicians that help assist the business people to do business easier in our country and in our county and our counties here in the Central Valley. So you have a eclectic group of people from people that have done a startup website that for noble reasons, Pinch My Salt was one of our honorees. And there's different – it's just an eclectic group of people. And what's exciting about it, every year you look at it and you think, are we going to find some rising stars every year? They're going to come through, and we're already getting nominations for next year. And the event's going to be held in November next year to be in its actual year, because we've always done it after the year, the class of 2012 with Tim's class. But next year in November, because we're already getting nominations for next year. And we encourage people, nominate them. Let us know.
And Mr. Finnegan, for you, like you said, being here and working in the family business, you know, just for yourself, and I'm sure because your peers, you all probably talk about this, but the importance of young professionals remaining in the Valley, staying in the Valley, and starting businesses, excelling in their own professions. Just how important do you think that is for the region and for Fresno?
I think it's huge. There's so many creative minds out there now, and there's so much, you know, creative stuff on the internet and the whole digital media out there. And for people to stay focused and, you know, under 40 or I'm 35 and still have that drive, want to keep going and take it to the next level and, you know, grow on what my dad's built or grow on what other foundations are. It's all about laying the foundation, and that's what we're here for.
And Lance, for you, because there's a reason why, you know, you started this and a reason why you chose to look at, you know, young professionals. How important do you think it is for the Valley just to retain and keep these individuals?
I think it's very important. Like at the beginning of the segment, we're talking about the number one export. It really is our youth and knowledge workers. Our healthcare community has done a real good job. A lot of times we don't recognize here in the Valley that we have an incredible healthcare system with community medical centers and what they're doing, and the St. Agnes and Kaiser, Cahuilla. They're all doing some incredible things. Venice Health in South Valley. So we're one of the leaders with UCSF, and those are young knowledge workers when they first come here, and we want to keep them here. And I know a lot of doctors like the late, great Stephen Parks from Community Medical came here as a young guy, came over cowboy, you know, a physician, and, you know, God rest his soul, he passed away a couple years ago. We recognized him as our Heroes in Healthcare
event.
Lifetime Achievement. It's another one we do. Lifetime Achievement recipient. And he was young when he came over, so I said, what made him stay here young, and it was he partied with some people and had a good time, and he decided to stay. But we're creating a party, and we're creating a party to network people. And what we hear every year, the 40 under 40, a couple years ago, I had a gentleman came to me at a – it was an expo. And he came up and said, "Hey, are you a chef here in town? I know you from somewhere. Are you Roy Harlan?" You know, and I went, "No." And they're say, "I know you from somewhere." And then I talked to him a little bit. He goes, "Oh, the 40 under 40, you're the Business Street guy. I started a business based on when I was recognized in 40 under 40 working for a produce company." Jeremy Lane was his name. And I went out and started a business. And the business is delivering ripe fruit now. It's called Ripe Now to your home. You couldn't ship it across the country. You get ripe fruit here right now. He always had an aspiration. But when he went and was recognized, he met people from Craig School of Business and all sorts of other people that did what he was dreaming about. So we created that connection. And that's what we want to do with Business Street Media Group, Business Street Online. The 40 under 40 is create connections. So you talk about young people. I'll add this real quick. 20-somethings. We're going to be doing the 20-somethings. 20 young people that are in their 20s that are doing something that needs to be recognized. So, we'll
and I think that's really great, really, is to be able to recognize individuals, because so many people here toil away. They're never recognized, but they really are the people that are kind of making, you know, this city work and what it is. For the event that's coming up, you call it networking. What can people expect at this event? And is it open? Can anybody buy tickets to come?
Yeah, anybody can buy. We do get that question every year. Someone calls and goes, "Do I have to be under 40 to come to it?" You know, no. The honorees are under 40, but you could be any age you'd like to be. And I always get harassed all the time. You know, the late mayor, Alan Autry, goes, "You know, hey, brother, when are you going to do the 50 over 50? You know, I always get that one. So I get that everywhere. But I read a book, and of all people, love him or hate him, Donald Trump. And Trump was talking about getting networked into New York. And what did he need to do to network himself to get in front of the right people? And he recognized them. And when he recognized them, he's noticed a different dynamic. It wasn't like they was asking for something constantly from somebody. He was recognizing people. And when he did that, one, it made him feel good because he was recognizing them and connecting them and helping them in their business life, and at the same time creating that connection for himself. And it's done it through nutrition. It's done it for myself. So at this event, it's an ultimate networking event. Not only does it do that for Business Street, but everybody connects. New businesses are started that we heard about. Tim's in the business to sell vehicles and sell cars, and I would want to buy from a guy that I know and trust.
That's on the list. Now, yeah. Tim, for yourself, you know, when being recognized or singled out in a situation like this, and you talked about, yes, it's great, but does it also do something to make you feel like you're on the right track when it comes to being a business person in a way, and that and the way I'm looking at it, that it would make you even want to kind of do more and to give back to this community?
Yes, 100%. I mean, to achieve something like this or to have standards and achieve those standards and go on from there and to give back is unbelievable. I mean, we went to an event the other night and we bought a table for a congenital heart disease and, you know, donated back, you know, bought a bunch of raffles and stuff. It's just a phenomenal thing to hear different stories of people in our life that you don't recognize every day that should be recognized, and to, you know, to give back to our community is unbelievable. We do a thing with Camp Sunshine for cancer survivor kids. You know, it's just it's huge on the heart, and to give back to someone and go from there, knowing that I have four kids of my own, and to make every day possible, they can look up at their dad and say, you know, he's achieved this at 40, he's keep going, and they're willing to go to work every day with a great attitude. That's what it's all about.
Well, okay, thank you both for being here this morning, Lance Cardoza with Business Street Online, Tim Finnegan with Fresno Chrysler Dodge Jeep Ram. The event is Thursday, March 21st, Skyroom Lodge at the Holiday Inn. Thank you both, and congratulations to you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Juanita.
Thanks, Lance.
Anybody can get tickets at 40u40.com.
Okay, like that. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra Romero and executive producer Joe Moore. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.